Okay, good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and get started on the call, and thank you very much for joining us. Just one of the things that we have to do at the outset of this is just to give you a brief compliance disclaimer, so please just bear with us. This call is intended for the dissemination of general information regarding market conditions to LoFS clients. The information we're going to talk about is not to be construed as personal investment advice. Obviously, past performance is no guarantee of future results, and there is no guarantee that the views and opinions expressed during this call will come to pass. In fact, things can change very quickly. So obviously, individual client needs, asset allocations, and investment strategies differ based on a variety of factors, and any opinions expressed are current only as of the time of this call and are subject to change without notice. Please note that the summary that we're going to talk about is again, just a general summary. And also note that this call is, in fact, being recorded, and your participation on the call serves as acknowledgement of the recording. With that, I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon. It's certainly been a very challenging past couple of weeks. We've tried to remain in close contact with you. And one of the things at the outset here, just to remind you that a number of you have actually emailed questions to me at greg@lowfs.com. If something comes up during the course of this call and you have access to a computer and you wish to have a follow-up question or a question that hasn't been asked, please shoot me an email. I will do my best to address it and get that question asked of Morris. One of the things that I thought would be just very, very helpful this afternoon would be just to give you a very brief explanation and summary of where we are right now. And then I'm going to have Morris talk a little bit about some of the comparisons of the 2008 and 2009 time frame and compare and contrast that with what's going on in 2011. We're going to talk about the summary of the global issues that are out there and then dig deeper into what's happening, and in particular the most recent development, the Federal Reserve statement of this afternoon, and the negative market reaction to that statement. So again, thanks very much. And as we've tried to communicate to you in our actively managed portfolios over the past couple of weeks, and for some time we've been reducing the level of market risk. We've been out of foreign equities in most of our allocations for almost all of 2010, and we're certainly glad that we are, given the continued turmoil, particularly from the European sovereign debt crisis. Additionally, we've further reduced the financial sector within our portfolios. We've moved out of high yield bonds in favor of higher quality bonds. And one of the things we'll talk about, and we'll spend some time on today, is the issue of bonds and what types of bonds may be appropriate to hold in the portfolios and what may not be. More recently, we've removed the bulk of technology and small company sector exposure. And we've also pared back the industrial sectors, real estate, and so on. We do continue to hold a gold position in the portfolios. We're going to talk about that today. I know we've gotten a couple questions about is it time to buy more gold? Is it time to take profits in the gold sector? We're going to address that. But in general, most of our actively managed allocations are presently about 50% in cash and only about 25% with equity exposure at the present time. With that brief introduction behind us, Morris, let me, if I can just ask you to maybe compare and contrast the market movements of 2008 and 2009 to where we are today in 2011.
Essentially, in many respects, both from an economic and from a capital market standpoint, we're back to 2009 levels. And so I think what we're seeing is the risk that we fall into recession again, and that the economy is pointing toward that, the Fed statement is pointing toward that, and the capital markets are reacting accordingly. We're seeing a huge amount of volatility and have for the last 30 days, and that's consistent with what we were seeing as we came through 2007 to 2008. A lot of volatility, a lot of wild swings, a lot of nervousness, a lot of avoidance of risk, and that's what we're seeing now.
And Morris, and certainly that I agree with that assessment, and you know, but all things considered, the market has not yet reached the 2008-2009 levels where the S&P closed at I think at its low about 676, and we're still you know above 1,000 on the S&P right now. The Dow was down as low as 6,443, if I'm not mistaken. So you know, do you think that we have that much additional downside potential in this market, or might it be a little bit of a different environment this time?
I don't think. First of all, there are very, very key differences. Number one, we were looking at a very, very severe financial crisis as we left 2007 through 2008. We had Lehman Brothers. We had Bear Stearns going out. We don't have that now. I mean, if we fall back into recession, it's going to be one of those grinding, eat-at-your-stomach type of things where the banking system, while recovering from wounds, is not going to be seeing the kind of wipeouts that it saw in 2008. So financially, we're in better shape than we were facing the kind of stress that we were facing then. The short answer to your question, Greg, is no, I don't see this kind of downside. I do see another 5 to 10% downside, depending on how slow this economy grinds down, what kind of recession it may go into late this year or next year. But I certainly don't see a 50% downside risk in the markets at this point.
And obviously, you know, and that's welcome news, obviously, and just to be clear, with everyone on the call as well, is that you know, that's not necessarily a prediction of market movements, but more an assessment of potential scenarios that could develop. Morris, do you think that one of the key differences in the current situation where we are relates really to the health of businesses and balance sheets? I mean, back in the 2007-2008 time frame, businesses were highly leveraged. They were operating with significant amounts of debt and using the debt to make the profit. Seems to me that you know, one could make the case that businesses should be better equipped to handle an economic slowdown today than they were back in 2007-2008. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. That's another critical difference between what happened then and what's happening now. You had the demand side of for businesses falling completely away, and then they had to spend most of 2008 into 2009 restructuring, pulling their cost structures in line with a lower level of revenues. That's been done already. These businesses are operating in leaner, more variable cost structures. They've already pulled in through the second quarter a great deal of discretionary spending. They've amassed enormous amounts of liquidity and cash flow, and so they're in far better shape than they were in 2008. So that's another very strong reason why you know, times are going to be different this time around if we go into a recession than into that abyss that we fell into in 2008.
Mm-hmm. And that's hopefully that'll be in a shorter duration if we're lucky with that. Obviously, Morris, there's a lot going on here in addition to the United States situation. We have a global situation with the continued European sovereign debt crisis. We have the U.S. debt and economic concerns. We have inflation concerns in China and some of the other emerging markets. I guess I'm going to ask you a two-part question here. One, if the European Union and the EU puts together a coordinated program to stop the bleeding from their debt crisis, and Spain and Italy are able to reduce the risk premium that they have to pay to investors to purchase their bonds. And in other words, this is really going to be a scenario where this is the same reason one of the concerns we had with the U.S. debt downgrade is that when your bonds have a lower credit rating, you have to pay investors a higher rate of interest to get them to take on that added level of risk. You know, if the EU puts together a successful program and is able to stabilize that region, do you think that the European contagion effect, so to speak, will be diminished, and we could see some stability returned to the global markets? And what would, and I guess in concert with that, what is it going to take to stabilize the U.S. equity markets?
Well, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of ifs in those questions, Greg. You know, the European Central Bank, the IMF, the European Union, has to beef up the vehicles that they would have available to stop the contagion. They've already made a first move by allowing Spain and Italy to essentially finance through the European Central Bank rather than forcing them into the public market where they were paying unsustainable interest rates. But the second part of that is they have to beef up that European Financial Stability Fund to a much, much greater level in order to be able to accommodate the weak countries in Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Ireland. And so there has to be very, very much more substantial work in providing the tools and the resources available to continue to allow these countries to roll debt over. But more importantly, they really have to have a fundamental change in their austerity program modality. It's not working. It's not going to work. And until they frankly bite the bullet and abandon the three-year austerity metrics and frankly go to a de facto default where they restructure the debt of these countries, extend the maturities, and lower the interest rates, there really isn't going to be a real solution. This is going to continue to bubble up and percolate as this thing inevitably, when the countries fail to meet their metrics or they're facing political upheaval, whichever comes first, and I think the second may come before the first, then we're sitting here looking at these, crisis to crisis, and again, it could all be generated by political turnover in the governments of these countries, and if they get a government in that repudiates the debt, then we've got even bigger problems. So I don't think, unless I see something dramatically different coming out of the thinking, something dramatically different from what the European Central Bank and the European Union have been talking and thinking about, but these Band-Aids aren't going to work, and they're just going to continue to have these sores fester under the surface. So until I see that, I'm not prepared to say that the Europe is going to stabilize and become a calmative influence on the world capital markets. As far as the U.S. is concerned, I think the hurdle rate that we're going to have to get over is this group of 12 plan that is coming in November for the next round of deficit cuts, and I can't overemphasize how important this is. The second round is going to be the more meaningful round of deficit reduction that is either going to make or break the Moody's credit rating staying at AAA and or S&P cutting the rating further from AA+. I don't have any problem seeing that group of 12 coming together with some sort of a cohesive plan. I don't think it can be sold to the Democrats or the Republicans, and I think it founders. And I think if it does, if it is unsuccessful, then I think that the credit rating is vulnerable to a downgrade from Moody's, which hasn't moved yet, and a further downgrade by S&P, and both rating agencies putting us on a credit watch with a negative outlook. And that will roil the markets even further. So I was
going to ask you that. Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt, but one of our listeners asked, if we had another rating agency downgrade in the U.S., would the impact potentially be more profound and wide-ranging than what we saw yesterday, where investors actually flocked back into treasuries as a safe haven?
It's very possible. The problem that we're facing here is that we're on totally uncharted ground. And so, normal tuition would have said to you that with a downgrade, people would have fled U.S. government paper into corporates. And in fact, what happened was is they essentially ignored the downgrade, and they avoided risk, and so they sold corporates and risk investments, and they flocked back into treasuries. I'm not so sure that's going to happen again if there's another downgrade. And remember, Moody's hasn't moved, so their move could be from AAA right to AA. S&P, which is a AA+, could move to a AA, and then the communique that they attached to it is even more just as important in terms of their outlook statement. So it very well may be that on another downgrade, there's actually movement out of Treasury paper and looking for safe havens, and I think the biggest beneficiary is going to be gold again.
And that actually goes right into another question. We've had two different questions on gold, Morris. We've had one question about There's been a remarkable run-up in the price of gold, and obviously from a prudent investment standpoint, one would look at an asset that's trading at or near its all-time high as a great opportunity to potentially sell at least some of the profits and lock in. Conversely, there's another question out there that says, well, okay, if this instability is going to continue, do we actually want to consider buying more gold? So can you speak to that whole issue and you know how this might factor into, you know, normal traditional type of investment philosophy versus what we're seeing right now?
Well, gold is high and it's overbought and it's extended and it's due for a correction. Having said that, you had a market that was up at one point over 200 points today, and gold is up another $57 an ounce. It's closing in on almost $1,775. We raised our allocation to gold at the end of July when it became apparent that these markets were really in turmoil and starting to really move to the downside. So we pulled all of our, from a strategy standpoint, we pulled all of our money out of the public markets, and we increased our allocation from roughly 5 to 7% in gold to 10%. So we are a firm believer that that gold is here to stay, and probably even more so in view of the fact that we're going to be looking at potentially more financial unrest in Europe and more financial unrest here in the United States. And the only repository left when you're really looking at a safe haven and fleeing paper assets and paper destruction is gold. Silver is moving down with the rest of commodities today. So we've said all along that silver is a trap. And if you're going to be in a precious metal and a hedge against paper, gold is a place to be. I would be a buyer of gold on any pullback. Any pullback that you see, I think, is going to be short-lived and is going to be very contained, because there are a lot of people that are thinking the same thing that I am, and that is increase our gold exposure. And as gold has run up and people have been laying back waiting for a correction, which hasn't really happened. So I think the correction in gold, if and when you get it, is going to be short-lived and is not going to be a big, you know, you're not going to see, I wouldn't think, a $200 per ounce decline in gold from 1700 to 15. You could get it, but I think that as gold cools back, people are going to step up and buy it, raise their exposure and allocation. So I really wouldn't be a seller of gold, because what am I going to put, you know, gold to me, again, is a significant allocation at 10% in our current strategy. And where do I put it in? If I come out of gold, my repository for it is going to be in cash. So I don't see a crash in gold. I don't see a gold bubble, which would force me to sell gold to go to cash to avoid a collapse. I don't see that. At most, I see a modest correction, which I would use for buying.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I think that's a good clarification. And just a couple points to clarify on your comments as well. And you know, when you talk about the target of gold at 10%, just so that our clients understand, you know, where that comment is coming from. As Morris works with us and works and develops target allocations and so on, you know, he has some ideal targets of ranges of thresholds where he believes and recommends that that we should bring portfolios to. At one point, we've been more at a 7% target, and you know, would use any pullback to gradually get up toward a 10% target, and obviously that percentage varies on a case by case and strategy by strategy basis. So I just want to you know make that distinction in the comments here. Moving on, you know, as we've talked about a lot of other issues, we have a question about oil. And you know, if we think back to 2008 and the time when oil was probably trading at over $130, it dropped back, if I remember right, almost into the 30s, if I'm not mistaken. We've seen a fairly significant pullback in that asset class as well. And I want to talk about the economic implications, and do you think that there's a further slide of a potential slide of the price of that commodity, and what that means, and if at any point that you would look at adding an energy sector into the portfolio, or would you stick with maybe a utility sector if we get into challenging times?
Well, oil oil is being sold. We're seeing almost a panic sell-off. Looking at the charts on oil, the selling volume has really dramatically picked up as we've come down through $90 and $85. We're currently at $78 on the current contract, which is the September contract. And I'm looking at a one-year chart here, and we are down below the levels of September of 2010. I think gold is in a free fall, and I think that you could easily see
gold. You mean oil?
Did I say gold? I'm sorry. I got gold on my mind. I'm very sorry. And we could see that this has further to fall because at these points now we've broken most of the major technical support levels. So in a panic sell-off like we're seeing now, where you and commodities are like this. When people think that commodities are collapsing, they just run for the door and they just pile out. Remember, there's margin calls and so forth. So when on a violent swing like you're seeing now in oil, you could get into the 60s. Now, I don't know if it stays there. In order for oil to stay in the $65 range, you would have to be in a protracted and significant recession where demand, not only in the United States, but across the, around the world, really dries up. And oil, from a supply standpoint, really gets into surplus. That's problematic. Yeah, I think Europe, for the most part, when you get past France and Germany, are either at no growth, slow growth, or recession. And it's just a question of whether France and Germany can hold the economic growth together in Europe. So demand from Europe is going to be down. Demand in the United States is already falling down. And as growth in the Far East and Latin America slows down as those countries stifle their growth to combat inflation, you would expect to have some sort of diminution in energy demand from there, but that's all relative. So I don't see a supply-demand situation that would dictate a $60-$65 a barrel price of oil. What I think you're seeing now is I think you're seeing commodity and other hedge fund traders just piling out right now, and they're pushing price of oil down. I would not be a buyer of oil here. We have a weak economy with slowing demand and the possibility of sliding into recession, which means that there would be little upside for oil to jump from roughly $78 or $70 back to $100. The thing that would change that, the fly in the ointment, would be the unrest in the Middle East. Now, to the extent that there is any kind of threat to world oil supply coming out of the oil fields in the Middle East, then you see a reversal of this, and oil could pile drive back to the $100 a barrel level. But failing that, in the very short term, given the trends that we're looking at, I would just step back and see where oil settles into. Oil on an intermediate, I'm going to say intermediate to longer term, I'm talking about, 1 to 3 years, is attractive at these levels and lower. And I would certainly be attracted to playing oil after it bottoms out or to get most of this panic selling done and basically sitting on it for a 1 to 3 year period. There's no substitute for oil coming on stream that's going to dislocate it on a secular basis. In fact, if a good bit of Europe abandons their nuclear power industry because of what happened in Japan, you're going to have an increase in fossil fuel demand coming for power generation out of Europe that's currently being served by nuclear. So that's why on a 1 to 3 year, 1 to 5 year basis, I'm positive on oil. I just don't want to step in front of this falling knife right here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think a couple other questions, and then we'll just try to bring this to a conclusion, and then certainly be welcome any follow-up email questions. We'll get back with you. An emailer asks, what is the probability and possibility of QE3? And if it happens, what would the effect be on both the equity and the bond markets? What would the potential effects be, I should say?
Well, at this moment, I don't think that there is a QE3 in the offing. Having said that, the Fed is going out of its way to tell you that they are prepared to do a QE3 if, as and when, economic and financial conditions warrant it. And what would warrant it? I think what you need to see is a severe recession, one that's accompanied by a credit seizure again, where liquidity would be drying up, banks would not be lending, it would be interest, you know, overnight interest rates, credit rates would skyrocket, a situation very similar to what we saw in 2008. And I don't think there's any question the Fed would immediately step in, pump in liquidity by any, you know, directly and indirectly, and do a QE3 to stave that off. Now, I think in the short term, then you would see a jump up in the commodity markets, and you'd see a jump up in the stock market. So if you replay last September, October, November, that's what you would get with a QE3. A pop-up in commodities, a pop-up in stocks, suppression of interest rates, and that's what you'd have.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you know, as far as the bond market goes, and one of the things that if you look at bonds and the challenges that can be out there, not only do you have to look at the credit worthiness of the bonds, we had for a long time been looking at the challenges that bonds would face in a rising interest rate environment, and obviously that has not materialized to date. We were earlier in the part of the year focused on higher yielding bonds that were more tied to an economic recovery and would potentially benefit from an economic recovery, yet had lower credit ratings. And we repositioned last quarter into bonds that were of higher credit quality, as well as corporates, avoiding primarily the government sector, and also going into very, very short-term types of holdings. Morris, as you look at this through the spectrum of everything that's going on, and again, we recognize these are uncharted waters, but do you see any real perils or dangers right now in the bond marketplace, or is the answer to that it really just depends on how things develop?
I think it's going to depend upon how things develop. Both the primary factor is going to be the credit rating. Is there a further downgrade coming? If there is, it's going to roil the bond markets. Yields will go up. It'll traverse across the bond spectrum, and it's going to be particularly deleterious to municipal debt. So I think municipal bond portfolios have to be looked at carefully in light of the current downgrade and prospective downgrade. That, to me, is the first and foremost part of collateral damage. Corporates will move up along the curve if yields generally in the government sector move up. But I think at some point people are going to look at corporates on their own from a credit quality standpoint and credit soundness standpoint, and it could turn out to be a haven for fixed income investors who are unwilling to take on the risk of government paper and municipal paper. The other area to be very, very careful of and I would avoid is government agency paper. It's one thing for people to go into treasuries as safe havens. That's full faith and credit in the United States. You don't have that full faith and credit in agency paper, and then a government agency paper could also be another area of primary collateral damage from these downgrades. The other area to be concerned about as far as yields are concerned would be credit risk. If we were to go into a significant or severe recession, which would call into question the financials and financial strength of both the public and private area, but particularly the private one. So the threat to corporates, I think, is primarily an economic one. The threat to bonds generally overall from an umbrella effect would be another downgrade in the sovereign credit rating in the United States.
Okay. And last question that we have for you, and then we'll conclude the call, is let's talk a little bit about the Fed announcement today. We saw the equity markets have a fairly strong open, building momentum throughout the morning. The Fed made their announcement, and the markets actually turned negative. Now
we're
sitting at 3:30. They're up. The S&P is up over 2%. The Dow is back up 1.5%. You know, do you just want to give any brief synopsis on your view of the Fed comments, and then we'll bring this to conclusion?
Well, I think what you're seeing in the markets today, yesterday, last week, I mean, it's incredibly volatile. I just can't describe how volatile it is, and that in and of itself presents risk. as to whether you want to be playing in an arena that has this kind of volatility to it. But what I think is going on is just this uncertainty. In the Fed announcement, the markets collapsed. Upon further reflection, the markets came back. I think that the people are trying to interpret exactly what the Fed is telling us, and I think the Fed is telling us what several of us have been saying for the last couple of months. This economy has slowed down to a crawl, and the Fed has said that it is in danger with a reduced outlook of slowing even further, which would mean possibly a recession. Having said that, the Fed is trying to reassure the markets that it's going to do whatever it can to head off a severe recession, one that would have dislocative financial implications. I think what you're seeing now is some comfort level in the fact that the Fed is prepared to act in any way it needs to in order to prevent the severe recession and that kind of dislocation. They're holding interest rates at where they are, at least through mid-2013. So that tells you that there's no tightening coming, at least for 2 years. So I think that's the way you have to read it. The Fed is telling you that the economy is growing slower than they thought. They've reduced their outlook for growth. They've raised the possibility their outlook could be reduced further. Clearly, this is going to be negative for job growth, and for job growth, you get consumption growth. So we're looking at a slower economy that could slow further, but that the Fed is prepared to step in and head off disaster.
Okay. Again, thanks everybody for joining us this afternoon. I just want to summarize this and just be clear. Our focus right now primarily, and most of our actively managed allocations, is first and foremost on strategies to potentially preserve capital. As we said, we've raised cash in most of our allocations to almost a 50% level of the portfolio. And in many allocations, we have 25% or less even equity exposure, and in the equity exposure, we have pared back what we believe to be the higher risk equity sectors in that portfolio. If things do continue to deteriorate and we see a need to further protect that any remaining equity exposure, we will certainly do so. Conversely, we're also going to be looking at times for opportunities. When we can start to put some of that cash to work under normal circumstances after a decline like we have seen, one would say, wow, there must be some reasonably good long-term opportunities to make a purchase here. And the truth may be that may be accurate, but we're going to move very, very deliberately, very cautiously, just because of, especially until we get past some of these debt issues and to see whether we can get a true reduction in the debt and as well as the other downgrade issues. So I would say to you that especially in the more conservative allocations, we're going to be cautious to purchase, but where we see the opportunities, we will certainly take advantage of that. We'll continue to stay in touch with you, communicate with you. We're always here to answer any additional questions that you have. And again, just want to reiterate that while we did talk about some strategies, even in terms of percentages on this call, this is not and should not be considered specific advice on which to act, because everyone's situation is personal and different, and what may be conceptually reasonable in certain circumstances may not be appropriate in your personal situation. So, you need to counsel with us before taking any action as a result of any information on this call. I want to thank Morris for his time this afternoon. I want to thank everyone for taking time out of your busy schedules to listen to our call, and we look forward to being in touch with you again in the very near future. Until then, have a good afternoon.